history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there that need to be told, and we're always better off when we take the time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And there's no mistake about it. I am sitting in the home of one of the few, the proud, the U.S. Marines of World War II. And I guess the first indication was the big Marine Corps flag flying underneath the Stars and Stripes in his front yard. Or maybe it was his belt buckle or his bolo tie or all the little bulldogs in his Eagle room, the Marine Corps rug, the Marine Corps sword, Marine Corps everything around here. Carl Appel of Los Osos, California. And Carl, I just can't get over the view you have in your home here. I'm looking out one way, and there's the familiar view of Morro Rock with the Morro Strand stretching down south along the California coastline, Hollister Peak in the other direction. I bet you never get sick of looking out your windows.
No, I certainly don't, and it was one of the best moves we ever made in our lives when we settled here in Los Osos. We just love it and never regretted the move.
And something else just hit me. I bet that there's probably nowhere else in America you can go to see something that looks as much like Mount Suribachi as Morro Rock right over there.
Yes, every time I look out there, it's a reminder. It's a little shorter than Suribachi, but it certainly resembles it.
Well, and when you go to Morro Rock, nobody's shooting at you, so that's a plus. And Carl was on Iwo Jima, and that famous scene that you've all seen reminds him and so many of you of that island that so many Marines fought and died for. And Carl was one of those who fought and got wounded but came home, and we're going to hear that story. But let's go back to the early years. You're growing up in Brentwood, Pennsylvania, outside of Pittsburgh with a sister during the Great Depression. What were those years like? Because I'm imagining people my age probably have a hard time really grasping what life was like back then.
Well, fortunately, my dad was employed during the Depression, and of course there's many things we had to do without, nothing special at all, but we did have to watch it pretty close as to our activities, and of course it was quite limited.
So what do you remember about those childhood years? Did you have some memorable activities? Did you have some hopes and dreams of what you might do someday?
Well, I think the thing that stays with me the most is that one day, of course, we were living in an apartment, and there was a salesman that came to the door that had children's books. And my mother signed up for these books. And that evening, she was reading one of the stories to me, and it was about the little train that I think I can, trying to get up the grade. And then he made it, and I knew I could or knew we could or something to that effect. And, oh, boy, I really loved that story and was looking forward to more of them. Well, when my dad came home, he, of course, wondered where this book came from. And my dad or mother said, well, I signed up to buy these. And he said, we can't afford them. So they had to be turned back in. And that was one of the biggest disappointments during that period of time for me.
And how old were you when you started skiing?
Well, I was in high school. A bunch of guys that I hung around with went skiing at some of our ski resorts that were in the mountains around Pennsylvania there. And I would say that I was probably, 14, 15 years old. We would go for the weekends. We'd go, drive all this way up on a Saturday, come back, and then drive all the way back up on a Sunday to keep skiing. So I really enjoyed that.
So much so that it motivated you when it was time to get into the service, as we're going to hear about. And I'm sure a lot of people associate skiing with the Marine Corps. But But I want to ask you about something else that it seems like everybody your age remembers and has a specific memory of. December 7th, 1941. Do you remember how that news of what happened way out on Oahu came to you?
Well, a good friend of our family and myself were actually deer hunting in the mountains around Pittsburgh there. Coming back on Sunday on the car radio, we heard about the Japanese attacking Pearl Harbor, which of course was a real shock to us. That's how I became aware of the outbreak of the war.
And you're there in the car, you have some time to talk about it with those other folks. Did it occur to you at all that that was something you might personally end up involved with?
Not at the time. That, of course, I had a rude awakening not too long after that when the draft came up and picked me up.
So when that happened, you've got to figure out what you want to do in the service. And can you avoid getting sent where they want to send you? And that whole skiing thing gave you a little idea?
Well, I had wanted to get into the mountain infantry because that, of course, included skiing, which I really loved. And so it was handled through the National Ski Association. I got all the papers necessary to get in the mountain infantry. And all I had to do was, when I was drafted, was to get into the Army. And then I would be sent directly to Camp Hale, Colorado, for mountain infantry training. So after my physical, I was given some papers and said, go sit down and wait till this young man at the table calls you. And so I waited, and pretty soon I was called up to the table, and the young man said, Navy or Marine Corps. And what a shock that was to me, because here I have all the papers filled out to go to Camp Hale, Colorado for mountain infantry training. And so I explained all this to the young man at the table, and he listened very patiently. After I got through, he said, what do you want, Navy or Marine Corps? Wow. Well, I've used my astute brain and figured out, well, I know darn well that the Navy doesn't have any mountain infantry or skiing. So I thought, the Marine Corps, that's the one where to go. And so I said, Marine Corps. The stamp fell on my papers, and a young man told me to go down to the recruiting sergeant for the Marine Corps and get your papers filled out. So I went down, the recruiter said, well, I have a chair right by this typewriter, and I'll sit here and I'll ask you questions, then I'll type your form for you. And one of the questions that he asked was, why did you volunteer for the Marine Corps? And of course, I went through the spiel about mountain infantry and so forth, and he just about fell off the chair laughing. He said, son, he says, the only thing you're going to be skiing on is sand. And how true that was.
I haven't seen any of those photos of Marines skiing on sand in the Pacific. So then you're a Marine. At least they were going to turn you into a Marine. And we've all seen the caricatures and the stereotypes of Marine Corps drill instructors. What was that really like, that training to become a Marine?
Well, at the time I went in, which was in 1943, the Marine Corps, and of course I went to boot camp at Parris Island. And at that time, the drill instructor could do anything he wanted to, really, with you. He could slap you around or cuss you, or it's anything he could think of he could do to you. There was an episode sometime later, and I think it did happen at Parris Island, where this drill instructor was running his troops through a swamp, and several of the Marine recruits drowned. And as a result of that occurrence, they really clamped down on what drill instructors could do. They couldn't put their hands on you. They couldn't use profanity when they talked to you. They're pretty limited as to what they could do. Not that that has had any effect, really, on the quality of the Marines they produced. They're still getting the same type of person that they want, but without all the hard stuff that they used to do.
What was the hardest thing for you to deal with?
It was digging French drains, which it requires pits to be dug and then gravel put in them. And that was one of the toughest things. And of course, the drilling, which was quite extensive. Of course, as I mentioned too, the Marine recruiters could do just about anything they wanted. They could fly out in the middle of the night if they so desired and march you and so forth. So, but I think one of the biggest things was those French drains. Because in Paris Island, it was pretty darn hot.
So you were probably excited to come out to the West Coast and get ready to go overseas. But I understand there was some business you had to take care of before that. And I guess I need to ask you about your late wife, Flo, because you two were married for 71 years. But it goes back further than that, that you were high school sweethearts?
Yes, yes, we were. In fact, I first saw Flo in the cafeteria, and I was with my buddy, and I said, "Who is that nice-looking young lady over there?" And he happened to be in her class at school, so he introduced me to Flo. And at first, she didn't want a thing to do with me. She thought I was a spoiled brat. But I guess I wore her down enough that she finally accepted me.
So you're getting ready to go overseas, and I don't know how you felt about it, but there's no guarantee you're going to come back, right?
That's correct. I actually became engaged by proxy, and by that I mean I had purchased an engagement ring for Flo from a jeweler in Pittsburgh that my dad had known, and so he had the ring there in Pittsburgh, and my intention was the next Liberty that I was going to propose to Flo. However, that didn't come along the way I wanted to. I ended up in Camp Pendleton, ready to ship overseas, and I still wanted to be engaged, so it ended up that my sister and mother and dad went over to Flo's home, and my sister proposed to Flo. And that's where I got proposal by proxy, or engaged by proxy. And the next day at Camp Pendleton, I got a telegraph saying, "I accept." And that was it.
I've heard a lot of stories, but I don't think I've ever heard the proposal by your sister and the response via telegram. That is pretty unique.
Well, Flo worked for Western Union, so she had access to a telegram very easily.
Well, at least that telegram said she said yes. It would have been a rough way to hear no. But now you're going to be going overseas. What did you really expect? Do you remember what that teenager was thinking about what the future might hold?
Well, as we sailed out of San Diego, I looked back at the shore and was wondering if I was ever going to get back there. Going into the unknown, combat and so forth, you just don't know what to expect, really. And I ended up, after we stopped at Pearl Harbor on the way over, and I ended up on Guam, where I joined the 3rd Marine Division, 9th Regiment. And we trained there. Of course, we didn't know at the time where we were going, but we were training for Iwo Jima.
Had you ever heard of Iwo Jima before?
Never. I didn't. It was new to just about everyone. We didn't know where it was or anything about it. But, of course, it was in the Japanese sphere of influence pretty close. And I know there's been questions about how necessary was it for us to take all that loss for that little island. But when you think about the number of aircraft, B-29s and other bombers, that would have been lost if we hadn't taken Iwo and had airfields there. Plus, Iwo provided air support, fighter support for the bombers that went over Japan. Like I say, on the trip back, they, of course, had sustained quite a bit of damage, a lot of them, in going over Japan, and they would have had to ditch, but rather than try to get all the way to Saipan, Tinian, and Guam. So as a result of us taking Iwo, we saved, I forget how many, crewmen and aircraft, of course, with the fighter escort. I don't know how many bombers we saved by having the escorts for them.
So those who speculate as to whether the cost and all the Marines who gave their lives there was worth it, you're really part of that cost because you were wounded on Iwo Jima, and you're saying, yeah, it absolutely was worth it.
Yes, and like I say, there's people that just don't agree with that, but if they look at all the statistics, they'll certainly see that it was worth our sacrifice to take Iwo.
And we're hearing from a guy who has thought of Iwo Jima so often over the 73 years since he was wounded there as a 19-year-old. Carl Appel of Los Osos, California is our guest today. You'll find photos and a short video of Carl at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll come right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with 93-year-old Carl Appel of Los Osos, California. He's lived there since 1980, but he grew up around Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And in February 1945, he was a 19-year-old Marine approaching a small volcanic island in the Pacific that he'd never heard of before, but he would never be able to forget. Nearly 7,000 Americans would be killed, and Carl would become one of the more than 19,000 Americans wounded in the five-week battle for Iwo Jima. And they didn't expect it to be so difficult to take. They didn't know what was hiding inside Mount Suribachi and all those tunnels and all those defenses. And it sounds like they didn't think they were even going to need your division, the 3rd Division.
Well, that's right. And they knew they were dug in, but not as much as they were, because they'd pop up out of tunnels, and then when they were getting shelled or something, they'd go back down. And so as a result, all the bombing and so forth really didn't do that good as far as eliminating the enemy.
Right, because before any Marines ever set foot on Iwo Jima, it had been bombed and shelled and just blasted by American forces for quite a long time. So if you don't know what's inside, you expect, hey, that's going to soften things up pretty well. And the reality was quite a bit different from that.
Correct. When we had the opportunity, or when I went back, I should say, to revisit Iwo on the 50th anniversary, we had a chance to look in some of these tunnels and so forth, and we could certainly see how the bombing wouldn't have affected them at all.
So your division is not supposed to be needed, but because the casualties were so severe, they call you into action. How did that unfold for you? How did you find out you guys were going in, and did you understand why?
Well, we were, floating reserve, and at night we'd pull away from the island. And then in the mornings, we'd pull back in close enough that we could see the shore, and we could see planes diving down and little dots running around on the island. It appeared that we were, inflicting quite a bit of damage. But then word came through the onboard speakers that we were going to be called in because of the terrible casualties that the Marines were taking at that time. So we transported the landing craft, and the balance of the 3rd Division landed on D+5.
Well, and as you describe being in floating reserve and being able to see what's happening, you know, the question that comes to my mind, and probably a lot of people listening, is did you see that one thing that so many people have seen since, because it's probably the most famous photograph of all time, the Marines lifting the flag atop Mount Suribachi, the second flag, there had been a smaller one put up earlier. Did you happen to see a Stars and Stripes flying atop the mountain?
Yeah, we saw the flag. We didn't actually see the raising of the flag, but we did see it when it was up there. That certainly lifted our spirits a great deal.
Was that misleading at all? Did it make you think that your side had made more progress than they really had?
Well, not necessarily. We knew that Suribachi was a real difficult thing to take, and that flag, when they put it up, they were still receiving fire from the Japanese in caves and so forth, were still entrenched in the Mount Suribachi.
So you see that from the ship, then they've got you 5 days after the initial landing, they have you on this landing craft going into the shore. So why don't we pick up the story there? What was that teenage Marine seeing, hearing, experiencing from that point on?
Well, when we were going in, they held us off for a while for some reason. I guess the shore, landing shore or beaches, were so jammed with destroyed vehicles and landing craft that they had to clear enough space for us to get in. And when we went in, of course, they dropped the ramp and we went ashore. And of course, there's a series of terraces from the beach up to the main part of the island. And I'm sure most of you can relate to running in sand. You take one step forward and you can go slide back too. So it's quite a challenge to get up to a place where we're on the level and could get into some cover. We progressed up to airfield number 1, where we dug in for the night. And during the night, we received some artillery shells in and around the airfield there. Fortunately, I was able to get into a foxhole that had already been dug, thanks to another Marine somewhere. And so I got in that foxhole and put my poncho over me. Then, of course, we'd get these shells in here. Unfortunately, none landed in my hole.
Did they land in some other people's holes?
Not to my knowledge. I did hear that there were some casualties, but I didn't see it or witness it at all. And the following morning, we moved up to a position of what they called immediate reserve, just behind the main line. When moving up, I saw my first dead Marine. I remember observing him, and apparently he had been standing on the edge of a foxhole, or shell hole, I should say. And when he was hit, he just fell straight back. I remember looking at his lacings on his leggings and just thinking to myself that when you lace those, you didn't think that you were going to end up like this. And in looking at him a little closer, he had been hit directly in the head and clenched in his fingers, his right hand, was the stub of a cigarette. And apparently he had been standing up next to that hole smoking, and the Japanese aimed at that cigarette glow and hit him right in the head.
That's got to get your attention and make you wonder what's going to happen to you.
Yes, it did. And they say there's no atheists in foxholes, and I certainly agree with that, because I did an awful lot of praying.
I believe it. Did you do much sleeping at all? I mean, you talk about that first night and then a second night. I mean, was it difficult to actually close your eyes and sleep?
Yes, I don't think that I really got a good sleep at all, because of the worry that you had and the shelling. It just wasn't conducive to sleeping. Actually, the second day, we'd moved up to airfield number 2, going to spend the night at that position, and then the following day go into an attack to try to take Hill Peter, which is north of the airfield. I was buddied up with one of our squad members, Joseph Bandiera. We started digging a foxhole or a hole so that we could get in. You know what it is like trying to dig a hole in the sand? It just keeps sliding in. I was assigned what they call a pickmatic, which was like a pick on one side and another blade on the other side of it, and that didn't work worth a darn in sand. And below us, there were two dead Marines, and they had been digging in to make a foxhole. They didn't have helmets. I don't know what happened to them, whether the Japanese got them or what, but they're bareheaded, and the one had a shovel, so I had that pickmatic. Well, that wasn't doing any good, so I went down and I got the shovel from the one Marine there that was dead, so that worked quite a bit better to get our hole dug. And about the time that we got it deep enough for Bandiera and I to get into, there was a stretcher party that came down over the bank, and we, of course, helped them get down. And when they got through, traveling through our area, they had caved in all of our hard work. We didn't have any coverage. And just shortly after the stretcher party went through, we got some mortar shells in, or artillery shells. And, of course, we both dived for the hole. Well, I was a little slower than Bandiera, and I ended up on top of him in this hole, and it wasn't quite deep enough because my buttocks was above ground level. Well, I got these artillery shells, and a piece of shrapnel hit me in the buttocks, and it stung, but it didn't break the skin. It just hit flat, I guess. So after that shelling, we started digging again, and we finally got the hole deep enough for both of us. After we'd gotten in the hole, and of course it had turned dark, and they were sending up star flares that would float down. And as they floated down, they would, of course, oscillate, and the light hit these two Marines, dead Marines, in the hole below us. And the way the flare was going back and forth, it caused shadows on these guys' heads, and it made it look like they were moving. And that was really a scary thing.
Well, the whole thing sounds like a scary thing. And I don't want to lose sight of the fact that you're still a very young man. What were you, 19 years old?
Well, I was at that time, yeah, about 18, 19.
And what was your realistic expectation in facing all of that, even just in 2 days that you've described for us of combat on Iwo Jima? Did you really think you were going to make it out of there alive?
Well, of course, hope springs eternal, and I was certainly hoping so. And after seeing so many casualties, it certainly put some doubt in your mind. Anyway, the following morning, we went into the attack to take this high ground. And, of course, the Japanese were firing down on us from this elevation, and we had to cross this open area. I saw Westberg, who was in our squad. I saw him get hit, and his ammo cans fly. And shortly after that, I was just about to dive in a hole, and when I was hit, the bullet, the angle was I was running in, and the angle that the Japanese were shooting at us, the bullet came right down by my head and right down along the inside of my leg, not penetrating, but just grazing me. And then it hit in my next to my heel and then in my ankle and just went on and into the ground. So it was just one of those what we term $1 million wounds. It wasn't serious enough, but it was serious enough that it got me out of combat.
Yeah, it didn't threaten your life necessarily, but it made it so you couldn't fight anymore.
Yeah, and had I been just a few inches to my left, it would have hit me right in the head. But fortunately, it you know, I was in that angle where it didn't hit me directly.
Well, and it sounds like that the angle that they were shooting at you from was pretty much right on top of you, so your head was the biggest target.
Well, I have a big head anyway.
What did that feel like? Were you in pain?
Actually, it felt like I'd been hit with a baseball bat. When I landed in the hole, I landed on top of my left foot, and of course it was all numb, and I was a little leery of looking at it, but I moved it out from under me, and I could see that, you know, it was a grazing wound. So I, of course, all carried a little first aid packet with a compress in there and some sulfa powder, and so I applied that to the wound. The Japanese, he was still firing at me even though I was in that hole. So I realized that this compress that I'd used was white and showed up quite nicely, you know, for a target. So I had a mosquito head net, camouflage mosquito head net, in my pack. So I took that out and wrapped that around the white bandage so that it blended in a lot better. Corman came up and checked me, and he said, well, you've done everything I can do for you. He said, I'll write your tag out and tag you. We have more serious to the wounded up in front, so you'll have to make your way back to an aid station. So I would get up, and I'd run a little bit, and the Jap would fire at me, and I'd throw myself on the ground and roll, and I finally worked my way back to a point where I was out of the range of the Japanese that was firing at me. I hobbled as best I could over somebody who was in our squad who had seen me going back, said they never saw anyone run so fast in one leg in their life. Anyway, I got back to the point where there were some walking wounded that were heading to the aid station, and they assisted me in getting down to the aid station where a surgeon or the doctor there checked me out. I waited there until they called them ducts. They're amphibious vehicles that they had, and so they loaded me on one of those with several other wounded. And I remember one of the corpsmen, he said, this man that's next to you, he told me, hold his hand. He had what we term shell shock. He would, least bit of noise, and he would shake. But when you held his hand, it gave him a sense of security, even though he was out of it, so to speak. Anyway, we went out to what had been a troop transport, but they converted it to a hospital ship. So they hauled me up on a crane on the stretcher, and then they took me down into the aid station in there. And as I was lying on the stretcher, I heard someone say, hey, Carl, and here it's Westwood, who I'd seen get hit earlier. He was waiting to go in to have the wound cleaned and so forth. And so, anyway, that was quite a coincidence to see him there.
You heard Carl describe how and where he was hit by that Japanese bullet, but if you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you can watch a short video in which he points it out for you. When we come back, Carl's road to recovery and what he did once he returned to his unit. Also, what was it like to return to Iwo Jima a half century after he came within inches of losing his life there? Carl Appel of Los Osos, California is our guest today, and we'll be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with World War II Marine Corps veteran and Purple Heart recipient Carl Appel. He grew up near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, but for nearly four decades now, he's made his home on California's Central Coast. Back in February of 1945, Carl was wounded while serving in a machine gun squad with the 3rd Marine Division on Iwo Jima. The bullet just missed his head, ended up going through his foot in the area of his heel and ankle. And while the battle continued for another month on that small volcanic island, Carl was recovering from what you heard him call his million-dollar wound.
Well, I'm just guessing, but I imagine you probably also saw a lot of guys who were in worse shape than you were.
Oh, very much so. Well, there was one young man that had quite a wound in his leg. Another young man had opened his mouth to yell and had a bullet go right through his jaws without injuring anything, without hitting his teeth or anything. So you talk about lucky, he certainly was. It knocked him out. But then he came to and ended up on the same ship that I was for medical aid.
And how long were you on the hospital ship? How long were you in the hospital period? How long was it before you could walk normally again?
Well, the ship that we were on, when it was had its full load, so to speak, we headed back to Guam, and I was in the hospital there for about a month. Then, after being released from the hospital, I went back to my division and my outfit, who had they'd returned from Iwo at that time, and I joined my old outfit again. And I developed a coral infection in the scar tissue, the wound on my heel, and as a result of that, it caused what they call a keloid condition, which resulted in me being not combat efficient, so I was then transferred to the personal effects section and until I had enough points built up to return to the States.
So when I asked you how long it was till you could walk normally again, was that a trick question? Is the answer never? I mean, is this something that has bothered you to some extent ever since?
Well, to a point, I can walk okay. But that, of course, that scar tissue can break open quite easily, even now.
And when you say they put you into the personal effects section, I'm sure there's some old Marines listening who know exactly what you're talking about. And there are a lot of other people who say, hey, what does that mean? And I don't think that was probably a very pleasant job either. What did you have to do there?
Well, actually, it wasn't too bad of a job, but I was responsible for making up a bill of ladings for the personal effects of deceased Marines plus those that were just being transferred back to the States. So I was responsible for that.
And you mentioned returning to your unit, the same outfit that you had trained with, that you had deployed with. But I'm just guessing, I imagine there were some guys who weren't there anymore who had been wounded like you or even killed.
Well, in our initial machine gun squad, we had 100% casualty, but no what we term KIAs, or killed in action. Every one of the original squad was wounded, but we didn't lose anyone, which is very unusual.
Very unusual. And how many guys in your squad?
I believe, if I remember correctly, about 7. And like I say, I saw several of them get wounded before I did. And like I say, fortunately, none of us were killed of the original squad.
And when you're sitting in that hospital on Guam for a month, what was going through your head? Were there questions that would roll through your mind, uncertainty about the future, thoughts of Flo back home, if you're ever going to marry her? What were the kinds of things that you were spending your time thinking about?
Well, I was thinking about, quite frankly, a lot of the wounded that were in there were, you know, quite serious. And so I was, of course, concerned about them. Something that sort of alleviated a lot of the worries, we had a very attractive nurse in our particular section. And so we just loved to talk to her. And sort of an aside story to that, she had recently been married And while I was in the hospital, this one day she came in with this nice-looking young man, Air Force, and she came up and introduced us to her husband. And he was in a fighter squadron and in the process of going to Iwo. And so the base arranged for them to have a little cabin or tent for themselves. Then he went on over to Iwo. Oh, I don't know, it was a couple days later. We saw all the nurses by the nurses' station, and they're talking and crying. We wondered what that was all about. And so one of the nurses came by, and we asked her what was going on. And she said, well, that the nurse that we liked so well, her husband, had been killed on Iwo. The Japanese had a bonsai attack, and they attacked the tent sections for these flyers. This nurse's husband had escaped to begin with and got into a jeep and was ready to drive off, and he saw one of his buddies that was having a problem with his, so he ran back to help him, and that's when he was killed. She was able to, they gave her permission to go home with his body. So that was a real sad thing for all of us that knew this gal. She was just a sweetheart. And I've thought many times to try to contact the Nurses Association to try and find out who she was, but in all probability she's gone now anyway.
I bet you can still remember her face.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, in fact, when they first took me into our ward, I was on this stretcher, and as they took me into the ward, I looked up, and here's this beautiful gal in white, and like a guardian angel, of course.
Well, and speaking of beautiful angels, did you get any letters while you were in the hospital from your fiancé back home?
Yeah, we did get some mail, of course. The telegram that my parents got telling about the wound, that was quite a shock to everybody back home, of course.
Well, eventually you got to come home, and you got to see her again, and you got to marry her, not to mention 71 years with her. Do you remember that moment of getting back home and seeing her and seeing your family again?
Well, I had deliberately not broadcast when I was coming home to Pittsburgh, and I thought, well, I'll, you know, surprise them. So anyway, the train pulled into the station, and I got out, and who's down there to meet me but my mother and Flo. And somehow they'd found out when I guess the base where I was discharged sent a notice to them that I was going to be discharged in such and such a date, and they figured out what train I'd probably be on, and there they were. What a pleasant surprise that was.
Well, and in all the years since the war, I know that you've done a lot. You spent 27 years of your life with the Fullerton Fire Department in Southern California. But everywhere I look at your home here on the Central Coast, I see a Marine Corps globe and anchor. So I'm thinking you're the guy who personifies that once a Marine, always a Marine. What does that mean to you, to be a Marine?
Well, it's really hard to explain to a person unless they've been through it. Because boot camp, man, they take you down to nothing and then rebuild you the way they want you. And so, like I say, unless someone has gone through that, they just can't appreciate the esprit de corps that the Marine Corps has. I don't mean to demean any other services, but I think the Marines have the closest tie-in of any of the other services.
Yeah, that brotherhood is strong. You mentioned earlier that you went back to Iwo Jima for the 50th anniversary of the battle. So this is 1995 we're talking about. What did you do there? What did you see? And what did it mean to you?
Well, of course, we flew in. They took us by truck to, well, I guess first of all, to Suribachi. And so we got to get to the top of Suribachi and see the memorial up there. And then later that day, they had a joint service with the Japanese. They had a presentation of flags and so forth, which was quite moving for all of us. Then after that, We continued a little tour of the island. We got to see into some of the caves and enforcement that they had. Then later in the day, they flew us back to Guam. But it was certainly a gut-wrenching day, because you remembered all the sad things, and also there were some good things, too, that came to mind.
Well, and I don't know where all you went on your little tour, but did you ever get close enough that you could see the spot where you'd been hit?
No, quite frankly, for one thing, over the period of years, the vegetation had grown back, whereas when I was there, everything was just barren. That all the shelling and everything had just knocked everything down. Airfield 1, where we'd gone for the first night, was no longer in existence, but Airfield 2 was. We did drive by it, but I couldn't really determine where it was that I'd been hit as far as the location on the field.
You know, I often ask vets if they've been to Washington, D.C. to see the National World War II Memorial. But in your case, I wonder even more, have you been to Washington, D.C. to see the Marine Corps Memorial with that giant statue of the Marines lifting the flag atop Suribachi?
Well, I did see that. I went on that honor flight. We did get to see the flag-raising memorial, but unfortunately, I couldn't get in. They didn't have any facilities for me to get into the Marine base there or the Marine Museum, which I have loved to have seen.
Well, I've got two questions for you on that. At the National World War II Memorial, looking at that wall of gold stars representing 406,000 Americans who died, so many of them your fellow Marines at Iwo Jima, what did you think of when you were looking at that?
Well, it, of course, brought back a lot of memories of the guys I've associated with. I realized what the number of losses that we were, just how serious things were. It was quite an experience to go back to see that.
Was there a thought at all of, if I had been a few inches to the left, I'd be part of one of those stars?
That entered my mind also. Yeah, but the good Lord had other things for me to do, I guess.
He sure did. And at that Marine Corps Memorial with the statue of the Marines atop Suribachi, there's a famous quote from Admiral Nimitz, which is in gold letters across the side, and it says, among the Marines in the Pacific War, uncommon valor was a common virtue. Did he get that right? And what do you think about that?
I think he was right. Well, I thought a lot of him, too, that Nimitz. Yeah, I thought a lot of him. That he was quite a guy, I guess.
Well, and if there's anything else you want to share, feel free, but I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your story to help us appreciate that price that's been paid for our freedom. You're 93 now. I know once a Marine, always a Marine, and you're very proud of that. But what would you say in your life you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Well, I think the first thing is having such a lovely wife. I feel very, very fortunate that Flo and I were married. It's a... That was a big thing for me throughout my life. She was such a support for me and such a good mother and just really great. And I think the other thing is being a member of the Marine Corps. Things that I learned at boot camp have followed me throughout my life and has had quite an effect on me. People saying that we shouldn't have wasted all that manpower on Iwo. But here again, I revert back to the number of lives it's saved and the planes that they've saved. And anyone that sees those statistics certainly can justify taking Iwo.
And who better to vouch for that than someone who left part of himself on that island all those years ago, who still deals with foot issues as a result of his injuries there, and who will always exemplify that motto, once a Marine, always a Marine. That is Carl Appel, 93 years young. Find photos and video of Carl at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.